Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio's Labyrinths in the News. Today is the ninth day of the spectral snake moon of liberation, Seli Root Chakra, Yellow Rhythmic Human Day. The affirmation is, I organize in order to influence. Balancing wisdom, I seal the process of free will with the rhythmic tone of equality. I am guided by my own power doubled, the power of free will. It's also Gregorian calendar, Monday, May 10th, 2010. I'm your host, Christiana, coming to you live from the Couve. That's Vancouver, Washington, across the river from Portland, Oregon, as I will be doing usually every Monday at 3:30 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. My lead-in music is the first cut, Icos, short for icosahedron, the water symbol in sacred geometry, off of Susan Alexander's CD, Sequentia. If any of you would like to chat while we are on the air, please do go to Christiana-Anea at blogtalkradio.com. My guest today is Welsh thespian and creator of a huge labyrinth installation on a high plateau in Wales. His name is Ian Briock, and I know I'm mangling his name, but I'm very happy to have him here as a guest today, all the way, calling all the way across the Atlantic Ocean. Thank you, Ian, for joining me today.
Thank you, Christiana. It's lovely to make contact finally. We tried before, didn't we?
Yes, but, we did.
I'm glad we made it.
Well, I can hear you very well. This is a good connection. Hooray.
Excellent.
First of all, let me first, am I mangling your name? How do I pronounce your name?
It's Ewan.
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 And
yeah,
how,
Ewan.
What about the last?
There's not many people in my own country who say it properly, so don't worry about that. But it's Ewan. Yeah.
I wasn't sure if the W was silent or not, so I thought I'd go for the modest Ian. So I'll go Ewan. And Briock is how you pronounce the last name?
That's correct, yeah, Briock.
Briock. And, okay, I have another couple ones. Cairdroia, is that how you pronounce that?
That's pretty good, too, yeah. Cairdroia, yeah.
Cairdroia. Well, boy.
I forgot about
the rolling R's in the Gaelic. Okay. Well, let's get right into it because I've got so many questions. What you're doing is so interesting. Tell us a bit about yourself, Ewan, and when you first experienced walking a labyrinth.
Okay, well, it's quite a long story, but I'll try and keep it short. I've been interested in kind of alternative ways of approaching things, if you like, for a while. I was studying film to begin with, and I wanted to make films that would not make a good filmmaker, because I wanted to make sort of TV and films that would make people throw their TV out of the window and go out on the streets and try and change things. I got involved in the whole process of making films, and the actual process of making films I didn't enjoy very much because this a huge technological translation goes on, and it's a very laborious process. And then I moved into theatre, I found that the immediacy in theatre that I was looking for. So I was acting in theatre, then I was directing. But then there was this huge wall, you know, there was the stage and then there was the audience. And I thought there should be some way of breaking that. In fact, you know, how actors, they often say, to people. You're an actress yourself, so you know when you ask the director, what's my motive? Well, I didn't have a motive to be on stage, really. I couldn't find a way to translate this kind of iconoclastic aim I had into theatre. And then I came across applied theatre. Theatre of the Oppressed was the main thing, and that I found, which is this process where the play shows a problem and the audience then participates in trying to solve that problem. So that was like the first stage, the first epiphany for me, if you like, that changed my attitude to theatre. And then the second, and this is answering your question about my first labyrinth. Well, actually, this might not be a labyrinth in the way that you use that term, but it's a theatre performance called Ariadne Thread that came from Colombia in 1994. It came to Europe. It was the first place it toured out of Colombia. It came to Spain and Wales. And it was a theatre anthropologist called Enrique Vargas who created this in the Goethe University. And I was very lucky to see it, and it completely transformed my perception of what theatre could do. Now, it wasn't a classical theatre design in two dimensions on the floor. It was a three-dimensional labyrinth. It was made out of black cloth, and you walked through, and you met these characters along the way. And it was a very profound experience. And so that was my first labyrinth. So I'm not sure if that qualifies. From what you think for labyrinths, but it was how I interpreted and developed that labyrinth aspect in my theatre work. And then in 2000, I had the opportunity to make a project with a kind of blank slate. And the first thing that came to my mind is, oh, I want to do this kind of theatre, this sensory labyrinth theatre. And I got the chance to do it, and it was, surprisingly, from like the first time I tried it was equally profound for the audience I went through it. So for the last 10 years, I've been developing this method, not as a kind of theater where there are professionals working and an audience come through, but I work with communities to create it. So it's a applied theater using three-dimensional labyrinths, using all the senses. And that's what I'm doing still. It's wonderful work, and it seems to have a profound effect on the people who experience it.
It sounds like the first thing that you experienced with the Ariadne Thread was more like a maze or a Pan's Labyrinth type of thing. But your labyrinth, okay, so I have so many questions just from what you said, but I'm going to try to stick a little bit to the script so we can get through, so my viewers out there, our listeners out there, can get a sense of what you're talking about here. Is there any way? Are you mic'd? Are you? Do you have a headphones on?
I've got a kind of phone that I plug into my computer.
Okay. Yeah, because you're coming, it's as though you're really close to the mic. And maybe if you can back a little bit away, your words will be a little bit clearer.
Okay. How's that? Is that better?
Yes, that is. That's better. Okay. Thank you. I have to be conscious of this because I have very limited resources to edit things here. So, okay. So when you first contacted me, you sent me three websites to look at, which I did. And that I was just really amazed by what you're doing. Your personal website is www.ewanbriok.com, and there's information about your projects and your workshops and your trainings and a bunch of other stuff. And then there's another website, www.troti.org, T-R-O-T-I, which is the Republic of the Imagination website, where you talk about context, quote-unquote, context-oriented theater. And I'll get back to these later, but I wanted to talk about that third site you sent me. It's Theater Sinfin, or is it Seinfin? How do you pronounce that?
Well, in Welsh, the C is always hard. It's like the K. It's a Cynefin, how you say it, yeah.
Say that again.
Cynefin.
Connecting. Wow. Okay. I would never have known that from the spelling, but I guess that's Welsh for you. On this site, it describes this theater as a sensory labyrinth theater company. Can you explain what you're talking about, what that means?
So this is the company that I formed back in 2000 when I tried this experiment with this, trying to recreate that experience I'd had in 94 with Ariadne's thread, which I spoke about. So basically, the labyrinth, like you said, maybe it's a Pan's labyrinth, I'm not sure, but it's an installation in a building. We hang wires across, and then we hang from those wires black cloth, long black cloth, like theater tabs, and we create pathways. But it's not a maze, you know, there are no dead ends. That's quite important. So sensory labyrinth theater is this form of theater where we create a labyrinth. I work with communities. They inhabit the labyrinth in different places. And they present what I call sensory portals. So they're a moment, an installation, if you like, where the actor creates or recreates a moment that's significant in their life, where they connected to something greater than themselves, you know, this kind of cosmic moment. And often those moments are connected with a sensory experience, like the smell of something, or the taste of something, a sight. So they recreate those, and then they present them to the person coming through. Now, the audience member in Sensory Labyrinth Theatre, the audience in Sensory Labyrinth Theatre is one person walking through the labyrinth alone every 5 to 10 minutes. So it's a very intimate experience. The audience, we find, feel alone. Maybe they feel alone for the first time ever, you know, to be completely alone, completely lost. The other thing about sensory labyrinth theater is because sight tends to be a kind of tyrannical sense, you know, that it blanks out or numbs out the other senses sometimes. These labyrinths are very dark. Sometimes there are areas in it that are completely dark. So we create a journey, if you like, for our audience to go through. It doesn't make much economic sense because
they come upon these actors at various places on that journey.
That's right. Yeah.
Is it just haphazard? Do you put the actors wherever? Or do you place them specifically so that the audience, the person coming through, it builds from one to the next to the next?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's a non-linear process in terms of plot devising. And what happens anyway is when the audience come out, they put the sequence of the incident or the installation into the order that makes most sense for them. So they create the narrative. You know, we only fill the bottle half full, if you like, and they see what they need to see, if you like, on that journey, and they put it together afterwards to make meaning for themselves. The bizarre thing is people see things that we didn't put in there. You know, there are a lot of spaces where there's nothing, just darkness. And often in those spaces, people report having seen things that we didn't put in there. So... But the important thing is, as you said, there is a very important and strong process that we go through with the actors to prepare them to do this work, because it isn't, I don't even call it performance, to be honest. The role of the actor is to be present and to use their presence as an actor to bring the audience member into the present moment as well.
Do they stay in the same place the whole entire time for all of the audience members? They don't shift around or anything?
No, they have their place. They have their moment. They have the thing that the portal that they, if you like, are the gatekeepers to that portal.
Center to this labyrinth? Is there a center space as you would find in most quote-unquote labyrinths that we know of that you just walk flat on. Is there a center area, or is it just a path with these locations that you come upon occasionally?
Well, no, there isn't a center. The center, if you like, is the, and the stage, if you like, is in the mind of the audience member. And what we find is the more they're walking through it, the more they become centered in it. Because it has the same, it doesn't have the effect, because I have created the Cretan design labyrinth as well. And I'll come I'll talk about that later. I can see the power of that, definitely, those designs. It's amazing. a labyrinth is also a path that's not going from A to B. You know, it's this path that you can't go wrong, but you are lost as well at the same time. So what I found is that when I walk in this path, the way I can explain it is that the left side of the brain goes to sleep because there's nothing to negotiate. So it's presenting a different paradigm of how to be, because we're so left brain orientated in modern society. We're always going from A to B. We always think there's something we should be doing or somewhere we need to be going. So this is a very different experience for people to be stuck, actually, to be captured in some way in this place where they're not going anywhere other than around the next corner, and they're lost. So just by its structure, its architecture, it has an immense effect. And so I'm very careful when I create these structures as well to present different kinesthetic challenges. You know, they're not just paths, the places you climb, you crawl, there's slides, there's all kinds of different kinds of challenges, if you like, that people meet.
Are your actors dressed in any particular way? Are they dressed in street clothes? Do they have costumes on? So when someone comes up around and is faced with someone sitting there, and they begin, do they just begin talking when the audience member comes into their view? They just start talking?
Well, it's completely dependent on the particular performance, you know, and the actor. I mean, I don't. you know, sometimes there's hardly anything visible, but usually there's some kind of costume. But I work with the actors to sensitize them to the spaces we're working in. So it has an aspect of site-specific theatre as well. We often use a lot of found objects as well, wherever we're working, the things that we find around that place. And also not just in terms of objects, but themes and local history feed into the themes as well. Yeah.
Well, you say your stated aim is, quote, to dream to life shared moments in space and time where fear and mediocrity are transformed into awe and wonder. And the inner and the outer become one. So can you give me some examples of this, of these kinds of shared moments in space that you're talking about?
I mean, that's one definition of theater that I've read, which I took from somebody, actually. Shared moments in space and time is a good definition of theater generally. What's happening as people are going through these dark labyrinths, and I'll contrast that later with the lighter labyrinth that I've done. You know. So they're walking along these paths, these dark paths. They're incredibly terrified. I'll speak more specifically at some point, but just to give a general idea. There's this transaction going on between terror, if you like, and curiosity. And I can't underestimate how terrified people are. You know, I'm very responsible about this, and I feel responsible, but there is a lot of fear in the beginning because people are not used to being completely alone and lost. But then there's this, slowly they find that there's nobody there who's there to terrify them or to frighten them. You know, everybody's trying to be as compassionate as possible. And then slowly they start to relax, and the curiosity overcomes the fear. And it's, in a way, it returns people to this childlike mind. Because when you think about it, children, you know, they don't know what's around the next corner. They never do, and they live in if they're feeling happy in their, you know, in their parenting, they feel this immense openness and wonder to the world. And we tend to lose that when we get older because we think we know what's around the next corner. So this labyrinth work is returning people to that feeling of not knowing what's around the next corner, and that brings incredible terror as an adult because you feel you should be responsible in negotiating things. But slowly, as you realize nothing bad is happening, you start to relax, and that curiosity increases and that openness increases. So that's what I mean by this fear and mediocrity turning into awe and wonder. And that mediocrity comes from, actually, if you think what you know what's around the next corner, then you're gonna kind of desensitize yourself to the wonder of the world, and you're going to live a mediocratic life because you're going to confine yourselves to what you think you know rather than seeking beyond it. And the other thing that happens in the labyrinth, and this is very strange, is that things, the boundaries between me and the other, the inside and the outside, start to fall apart. And you can think that you initiated an action, and then you compare notes with somebody afterwards, and they said, "No, you initiated the action." So there's this kind of spontaneity happening, an improvisation, where nobody is leading, and that's it. You know, I work with the actors to do that, to meet that person in that moment.
So the lines between actor and audience blur. But that's what you're talking about when you call it immersive theater.
Yeah. I mean, immersive theater in the sense that, you know, it's all encompassing. You know, the hero of this play is the audience member, and that's the other thing they start to realize as they're walking through. They think, I'm the main character in this. Everybody's here for me, and that completely kind of turns on its head everybody's idea of theatre, experience of theatre. And they feel the Vedic concept of Leela, people seem to get that, you know, and the changes that we see in, not everybody, you know, but a lot of people who go through labyrinth, they say, you know, my old life is over, my new life is starting, you know. I can't go back to that now. There's some very important opening that happens there.
And how many of these have you done over the last couple of years?
I think I'm in my mid-20s, 25, something like that, I think.
And what is the audience size?
Sorry?
What is the audience size? How many people do you do this for in one shot sitting?
In one sitting? About between 30 and 50.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, so how long is when the audience enters the labyrinth to the time they exit? How long does that take?
About an hour. It could be more. You know, we don't throw them out. Some places they can stay, especially in the end. What we call it, if you like, the decompression chamber, to prepare them to go back into the outside world, and people can stay there as long as they like. it means we're in there for 4 hours, you know, 4 to 5 hours.
Wow.
Okay. And so it's a kind of practice as well, if you like, a meditation practice for the actors. It's quite a give, if you like, and that's something the actors. And when I'm saying actors, I don't mean just professional actors. I'm talking about communities that I work with as well, because what we often find is, you know, it's a very open process, so that somebody's gone through the labyrinth as an audience member. Sometimes will come, wait till the end and come up to me and say, can I be in it? And you can sense that they've got something and they want to give back. And then I work with them in the next day to find the location that they want to be in and what they want to do. And then they become an actor. But it's an experiential thing, you know. If it touched you, then you won't do anything wrong in there towards another person because you've been touched in that way. You know what it's about. You know?
When a group or a town or organization calls you and says, "We want to have one of these in our town or in our city or whatever," do you come there with actors already prepared, trained, or and then you work with their community, or do you actually train the actors out of the community first and then create the installation or the?
They're all different. I mean, I've been asked to come to do festivals, you know, and I turn up with a group of I pull actors from all over Europe to come to that performance. But most of the time, I train community volunteers, and I'll bring a few actors, experienced actors, into it as well to help, you know, because it's good to have some key staff there as well to keep. So if you like, field areas of the labyrinth, because as a theatre director, you can't direct it once it's performing because you don't see it, you don't see the performance, but you can feel it. You know, and I'm often in the labyrinth just feeling out how it feels in different places, and I need other experienced actors to feel out that, you know, especially in the big labyrinths because it's difficult to cover a lot of spaces. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to talk a lot more about this, but we have a lot more questions here. What does mean? What does that mean, and where is this installation located, and who built it, and what kind is it?
Okay, well, the Caerdroea is the Welsh word, and it's actually Caerdroea. The Welsh word for labyrinth. And I think it's you might have heard of a journal called Caerdroea, which I think started. Well, Caerdroea is the root meaning in Welsh is a city of turns, and it's also the Welsh name for the city of Troy. So when you refer to Troy in Welsh, you say Caerdroea. So it's an interesting connection there. Welsh farmers in times past, the tradition had died before I revived it, but they used to make these turf labyrinths on the tops of hills, and they called them Caerdroea. And I think now, I might be wrong, but I'm not sure, but I think the official name for those turf labyrinths internationally is Caerdroea now. So you've got this Welsh tradition on the hills called Caerdroea. So you've got this connection to Troy town, and there's also this ancient, probably a myth, about one of the descendants of Troy came to Wales, Brutus, not the same Brutus as in Caesar in Rome, but an earlier Brutus came to Wales and brought this tradition with him from Troy, and there was a dance associated with this Caerdroea, but anyway. I was asked to do a project with one community, and there wasn't a space large enough in that area for me to make the internal labyrinth. But there were lots of forests, pine forests. And I asked the Forestry Commission and the local community whether they'd be interested in helping me to make a permanent installation on the mountain out of the forest. So it was a small kind of nursery forest, if you like. They were about 15-foot high. For Thai and spruce, pine, I basically carved the shape of a Cretan labyrinth into that. It's a mile long, and we constructed a path. I've tried to do a performance there every year. I didn't succeed last year, but so that's the kind of an installation that we use. We do nighttime labyrinths there, and we do some of them are summertime labyrinths, and we also. Theatre Canavan now has several staff based there who do different kind of festivals there using this Cretan design. It's not,
and where
not
is it located?
It's in North Wales. It's in a forest called the Gwydir Forest. It's not geometrically correct. You know, I didn't use GPS or satellite navigating system. I just went, used my instincts. But there's the feeling of, you know, it's a spiral path where, you know, and it's the seventh circuit labyrinth. And then in the center, and then you come directly, this is sacrilegious probably, but you go to the center and there's a path directly from the center back out to the entrance. Because it's
and
a mile
how
long.
Wide are the paths? I mean, you said it's a mile long. How wide are the paths?
It varies, but it's about a meter to 2 meters, meter and a half. Yeah, and then you have these trees on either side. And the local community are maintaining it, but they're also kind of maintaining the path, but also they're building structures there. And then they're thinning the woods, and they're bringing back the indigenous trees as well. We planted lots of trees around the path because it was very much a monoculture when we were there.
Well, it looked like there was a picture of two trees, two birch trees, looked like a very thin trees with an archway in between. Is that taken from that site on one of your websites?
Yeah, when we opened it, I worked with about 100 artists, poets, and sculptors, and we put it out to international artists who wanted to come and make an installation. And there was a Hungarian artist who came and created this moss wall, a moss gateway that you walk through. Unfortunately, it's not there anymore. It's 5 years ago, and this is on top of a mountain, so you can imagine the wear and tear that these sculptures get from the weather. But that was very, very nice installation. Yeah.
And how did you make the path? Did you mow? Are the paths mowed grass, or?
Well, it's wood chip that's put down every year. So it's I wanted to make it semi permanent. I didn't want it to, you know, partly I didn't want it to damage the environment, but also didn't want to impose something on the local community that they might not like or they might not adopt. So it was up to the community to continue to maintain it, and you know I was happy for nature to take it back if it didn't take off, but you know it was very, very successful, and they like it very much. whenever I'm up there, which isn't often nowadays, there's always people walking in it, you know. And it's not easy to get to. It's not easy to find either. But, you know, it's people use it as a meditative path. And also people take, you know, I was doing a project there 1 year, and there was a lady with an autistic child, and she said that she'd never seen her child be so relaxed and play for so long in this space. So there are people using it for healing as well. For children with hyperactivity and this kind of thing, and I'm sure it's to do with this switching off of the left side of the brain and pushing the energy to the right side of the brain.
Mm-hmm. And children, you know, respond so much more quickly too. So, there's less in the way, and
yeah.
So you mentioned you use it for training. You use this site for training, and one of the trainings is called the Rites of Passage training. Can you tell us a bit about that? What is that about?
Oh. Well, one of the other things I'm involved in is a network. It's called Drums for Peace, and it's been going for 10 years as well. And it's a network of artists in Europe, and we coordinate and organize youth exchanges. We bring young people together from disadvantaged backgrounds, and we do youth exchanges. Now, one of the trainings, and one of the things I offer to this network and to other networks as well, is a training for young people, because you know young people have become going into adulthood, and there is no rite of passage. I mean, I think in Britain, the rite of passage is to get paralytically drunk, you know, with your friends, and survive. And it doesn't seem like a healthy way to become an adult. So this is very much about that transaction between terror and awe, you know, because we use the Kaidroya at night time. It's very, very dark. The young people go through a process of opening up over a week. We work with them, sensitizing them to nature. And they're often young people from difficult backgrounds or in a difficult place. And then they go through the labyrinth and you know, I've been working in that community for long enough, I can call on people to come and inhabit it just for an evening for this training. And then they go through one at a time. It doesn't matter what the weather's like, and it can be often cold and raining up there. And then that becomes a kind of this rites of passage that they experience. And then the important thing is that then they use that space to create a labyrinth that they offer back to the community. So the community often gets these performances in return for their giving. So yes, I like that kind of exchange that happens.
And how long is this? You know, workshop kind of thing go on? Is it a couple of days, a week?
It's a week. It's a week to 7 days, yeah.
That's about a week to 7 days. Oh, that's great. That's wonderful. We have things like that in this country, but I don't think it has. I'm wondering now if any of them use labyrinths. They probably do, but I haven't heard about it yet. I'll have to find out. You write that you build site-specific installations in large interior spaces. Is this what you're talking about before, about the...
Yeah.
Or is this different?
No, this is the same thing. I'll talk about two installations, actually, because they might be interesting. The first one was probably the biggest labyrinth we made. It was in Portugal. It was launching the European Year of Disabled People. And we work with disabled groups there to create this huge structure. And so sometimes we're asked to do a labyrinth about a particular theme. What we have to be careful with is, you know, that people come, and if they have this theme in mind, it'll frame everything. So you could put something completely irrelevant to the theme, but they'll interpret it as that theme. for instance, with that specific labyrinth, people were thinking we were trying to, you know, before they went in, they thought we were going to try and give them a sense of what it's like to be disabled, which is really not what we were trying to do, and a bit patronizing. But they came out, a lot of people came out saying, you know, I've been working with disabled people all my life, and I realized I know nothing about it. So in some way that it you know, something magical happens in these labyrinths where people get what they want, what they need, and what they want. So that's one large installation we did. Most of our labyrinths are interior, site-specific labyrinths. An exterior one I did in Austria 2 years ago now. It was quite interesting, quite powerful. And I used the man in the maze pattern that you've used, Christiana. I know you've used it. It's a wonderful design, beautiful pattern. And I used, it was with an artist who lives on a farm in southern Austria, in Carinthia, a man called Strauko Haderlap. And I don't know if you know much of the history of Carinthia. It's in southern Austria. There was a large Slovenian population before the Second World War. And it was one of those situations during the Second World War where you had a choice of joining the Nazis, joining the resistance, or going to Auschwitz. And the different people in the same family made different choices. Mm-hmm. So I was really shocked to be in a place that was still so affected by something that happened 60 years ago. You know, it's a community struggling with something that happened because, you know, families are still divided. The Slovenians are still living in a place which is very far-right politics happening in that place. Anyway, Slauko had this big barn, and it was full of all the farm implements from 300 years working on that farm. And also his family had some kind of responsibility, they felt, to record their family history. You know, several of their relatives were taken to death camps, and some of them survived. But so we created this memorial, if you like, in the shape of a Martin and the Maze labyrinth, out of these implements, out of these farm implements. So it's, on the one hand, it's a labyrinth, but it's, I don't know if you've seen a picture on the website, but it's kind of like it rises up in the middle. So actually, on the outside, it's quite flat. You know, you can see everything, but you go in and it gets darker, and you come out again. And the important thing with this labyrinth was that we planted trees along the whole path, so eventually these trees will grow, and they're willow, you know, they'll grow near each other, and hopefully they'll lift these rotting remnants of farm implements up into the air. So, you know, they're kind of, I use a lot of creative license when I come to making these labyrinths, so that they have some kind of significance to this.
How big is this labyrinth?
Oh, that one's kind of normal size, really, about 50 foot across. Yeah.
That's not normal. That's big.
Is it? All right.
My little one was only 24 feet. You know, yours, that, right. I was going to say that for farm implements, usually I work on them. They can be pretty big and hefty, and even if they're in pieces, their pieces can be pretty big. So 50 feet would sound about right, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if I saw that on the website. I'll have to go check again. That sounds fascinating. Yeah. And what was the reaction of the community?
Well, that the labyrinth is called the Labyrinth of Work Done. I don't know why it's called that, to be honest. But maybe because these implements are not going to be used anymore. Well, you know, they were a bit, you know, it was a different outing for me as well, because it's wonderful when you have these interior labyrinths because you can control the environment. But in the outside, you know, I've only performed it at once, which was the opening. And it was very moving. But the audience was kind of sitting outside watching other people going through it. So it destroyed that intimacy, you know. So it wasn't exactly, but it's still there. And probably needs a bit of maintenance. I'll try and do that at some point.
So you have a description of sensory labyrinth theater projects. In that description, there's a mention of constructing sackcloth labyrinths. And then I quote, through which the whole community is invited on a solo journey, barefoot through the darkened passageways. So this is what you've been talking about so far. These are sackcloth labyrinths. It's this beast of black cloth.
Yeah, it's not really sackcloth. It's cotton twill, but you know, people don't. Sackcloth is more of an understandable term. Yeah.
And it's high. I mean, the walls are high, so they can't see over the tops.
Yeah, they're about 3 meters high. Yeah.
3 meters high, and you walk barefoot.
Yes, you know, it's you know, the idea is for the whole body to become eyes. You know, the feet to become eyes, the hands to become eyes. So you're very embodied because you're using all your senses.
And if it's so dark, and if they can't see their way, do they reach out with their hands? Does the sackcloth, the fabric move? So are they fearful of tripping or falling?
They're reaching out. Yeah, but you know, when you're in the labyrinth, your eyes get accustomed as an actor, so you can often see people when they can't see you, and there are a few people in there whose role is just to keep an eye out on them. And to be honest, actually, in the labyrinth that I went through back in 1994, the most powerful thing that happened to me was in a place where I was completely lost and I didn't know where I was. And just at the right moment, a hand came and held my hand and just led me just a little bit. And it was, I wasn't sure whether there had been a hand or not. And that's what I mean by this inner and outer coming one. And it was just recalling that moment afterwards, I realized that I'd had that all my life, that there's always been a hand reaching out to me. So it was a very powerful moment. And so the simplest things, actually, and that's what I try and say to the actors, less is more, you know, it can be very simple what we do. and I've been in that position of being in that dark place. that was when I recall in the labyrinth in Ireland, and being in a very dark place and waiting, just standing there waiting for people to just stop and be completely lost and just putting my hand out. And it's very, very subtle how you put your hand out and how they touch it. Some people, you know, a very small minority, often jump and shriek. But some take your hand and you lead them on, and you can tell that that hand has reached into their soul, that they're actually not aware that there was a hand there, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of art, which I'm still working on, probably.
That's amazing. You use a labyrinth in your community chain projects. What is this application?
Well, I haven't succeeded with that totally, but the idea is that you know, you work with a community. Well, I have in situ, if you like, in around Caudroio, as I said before, you know, with the rites of passage training, the community gives a labyrinth to the guests, and the guests give a labyrinth to the community. But what I like to do is to work with the community to create a labyrinth, and then the next community who are going to make a labyrinth goes through that labyrinth. Because one of the problems with this work is it's very, very difficult to explain it to people. You know, they just don't have vocabulary, if you like, or a belief that theater can be so powerful and relevant anymore, you know. And so, you know, it's incredibly experiential. I spend a lot of time trying to explain it and failing. It's so much easier for people just to go through one and often, you know, almost always, you know, everything is word of mouth. With this.
Word of
you know,
mouth, right.
We're not very good with PR, but, you know, things grow. And so, you know, if a community went through, they'd want it, and then they could create it. So just to create that kind of domino effect, if you like, but I haven't managed to line up the dominoes yet, to be honest.
How long does it take you to set up this? Set up a room, set up a space for this?
Oh, you know, it varies how long is a piece of string. A month is nice to have, but I've done it in 3 days. I did one in Venezuela in 3 afternoons. You know, but the longer I have to make it, the more powerful it can be, I guess. But that's not
because
true either. You know?
I think this would be an awesomely cool thing to do at one of the TLS gatherings. And if we could get the space to do, and you would take a room and create this, and this would be one of the workshops, oh, my golly, it would just be phenomenal. It would be incredible. I just would love to be able to make that happen. We have to continue to talk. The show is on, but it's not streaming, so it's just you and I. It's being recorded, so when people hear it, they'll hear this part. Do you have any new projects on the table for this year and the next couple of years? What's going on with you lately or in the future?
Yeah, well, I was commissioned by the Arts Council here in Wales in January to write a labyrinth script, which I haven't done before. And we wrote it. It's called The Mirror of Darkness. We're hoping to stage that next year. Also, one big project, which I was hoping to already started, it didn't work out like that, but it's called The Republic of the Imagination. That's what the website is about. It's actually a school of what I'm calling context-oriented theater. So it includes the labyrinth work, but there's other practices that I've been developing influenced by the labyrinth work. You know, this whole thing I mentioned at the beginning about wanting to create movies that makes you want to throw the TV out the window and go out onto the streets. Well, you know, if you equate the theater stage. If you orientated your attention to the context of it, just like when you're watching a TV and then you see the frame of it, that's the context of the TV. And so what's the context of the theater? It's people, it's humanity. It's the moment. So I'm working with all kinds of different theater methods to orientate us towards the reality of our divinity, if you like. So this school, which I'm hoping to set up, is for young people to develop this, to work with me to develop this kind of theater. And I was supposed to start in Portugal in March, but unfortunately we were betrayed in that case, that place, so that didn't happen. We're looking for other locations for that.
Are you having trouble with finances, and is the economy as bad there as it is here? So I'm sure it's money is tight, and trying to get these things put on is difficult.
Well, that's the problem. Yeah, it's project to project basis, you know, and it's just stepping from stone to stone and hoping that there isn't too big a gap between them, so you don't fall in the water. You know, that's how it is.
And how do you think we can connect the people here, us here with you in Europe and the Labyrinth community over there, and to share our ideas and stimulate this growth and this incredibly creative use of Labyrinth, where, you know, we all get in ruts, and over here we're just so used to using them in certain ways, and this is like a breath of fresh air to me. I mean, I would love to have you come and do something in one of the gatherings. It would just be so different. So what do you think? What's your feelings about this?
Well, that's I would love to. No, I would love to. And I mean, this is the beginning, isn't it, Christiana? You know, we've made this contact. I got your contact from a colleague in Ireland, Valerie Whitworth, who's, I think, been over to work with some you know, that you're the same teachers you've had. And so, you know, she introduced me to the two-dimensional labyrinths, if you like, and the walking, and I can see the integrity of them. And I think there's a lot to learn from each other, you know. You know, my website, the personal one, uanbriok.com, has a dialogue section which people can write on. And you know, I'm developing the theory of context-oriented theater there, so people can read about it and input into that as well at the same time. I'd love to meet up in person.
Well, I know I would love you to get in contact with Jim Buchanan, who does the Light Labyrinths in Scotland.
Yes.
Because
that's right.
He's a pretty interesting guy too, and the two of you, I mean, that's what excites me, is to getting these creative people together, getting you guys together, and you know, the sky's the limit. Who knows what you can come up with when you have this kind of creative flow between each other, and you know, there's just in the with the countryside and how pretty it is over there, and it just seems like you can do some really fantastic things.
Yeah,
together.
Was it Jim?
So.
I heard about an island that is turned into a labyrinth. The whole island is a labyrinth. So you come onto the jetty from the boat, and that's the entrance to the labyrinth. And I don't know if it was Jim that did that, but it's somewhere in Scotland, off Scotland. Yeah.
I didn't know that. I'm going to have to look into that too. That's fascinating. Well, we're out of time, and we're way out of time.
Okay.
but I mean, and I would love to talk to you some more about this. But certainly, we should stay in touch and see if there's some way we can get you over here. You know, the logistics and the money thing and all that. I don't know how that would all work, but if it's meant to be, it'll happen. That's what I found with Labyrinths. If they really want to be. Put up and created, and it, you know, somehow or another, heaven and earth has moved, and it happens. So, but thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thanks for your patience. I know we talked before, but
Well, you know, these things happen when you're trying to connect across the water like that, you know. But it is my intention to enlighten Labyrinth neophytes and support Labyrinth veterans with guests like you who provide a depth of information and personal experience not available through other sources. So many, many blessings on your path, and let's stay in touch.
Yes, thanks, Christina. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye. You've been listening to Labyrinth in the News in the Life category on blogtalkradio.com with your host, Christiana. Please join me Monday, May 17th, when my guest will be Nancy Iyer, one of the key presenters at the April Bainbridge Island Labyrinth Workshop Series and an Advanced Veritas Certified Labyrinth Facilitator. Join us as we talk about the soul, the labyrinth, and ancient mythologies. Have a blessed week in Lakesh.